I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 10th of March, and the weather is beautiful. All things political this hour, and our guest is Jill Lawrence. She's a veteran journalist who's covered every presidential race since 1988, contributor now to The Daily Beast and Al Jazeera America. We have a lot to talk about. The CPAC conference took place the last few days. She says that they are dealing with an empathy gap, the GOP trailing the Democrats 45-17% in an NBC Wall Street Journal poll on which party does a better job showing compassion and concern for people. But on the other hand, the president's approval ratings are going down, and that always spells trouble for the party that's in office for midterm elections. So we ask, what are the chances of the Republicans winning the Senate? For those of you who are true political enthusiasts, and that includes everybody in the audience, she says we should pay attention to Florida's 13th District special election, which is taking place tomorrow and has taken on very large national political significance. We'll talk about why that is the case. The Affordable Care Act, Gallup has a new poll on the uninsured and finds that 5 months into the Affordable Care Act, the rate of uninsured Americans has dropped to the lowest point since 2008. 15.9% of adults now uninsured, down from 17.1% at the end of 2013. There are concerns, though, that the uninsured rate for the 18 to 34-year-old group is dropping, but not yet to the levels that the administration hopes for. We'll talk about the latest in Ukraine and U.S.-Russian relations, and a number of other issues, a busy all things political. You are always welcome to join our conversation. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also very with it. We're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Hello, Jill Lawrence. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi. Nice to be with you.
Yeah, nice to have you here. We have a lot to cover. Why don't we start with the CPAC conference? Who was the star?
Who was the star? Well, I would say Rand Paul. Mm. I don't know if that conveys to any larger forum, but he certainly had it in his pocket at CPAC. And part of that was because of his pre-organizing skills. There were something like 500 people there from Young Americans for Liberty, which is a campus-based libertarian group. And if you consider there are only 2,500 people who voted in the straw poll there, you can see why he did so well. He won with 31%. So, you know, he had a lot of support. He had a lot of applause lines. He talked in very conceptual terms about liberty and about, you know, what you do on your cell phone is your own damn business. And he got terrific response and from an audience that he had tried to tailor, in large part to his fans.
Are more people considering themselves libertarians?
Yeah, I don't know if they're considering themselves libertarians or they're finding particular things that he is talking about very attractive at this point in time. You know, he kind of has hit a moment where he's in sync with a lot of people, whatever they call themselves, when he talks about privacy rights and he's suing the National Security Agency for overzealous surveillance. He's talking about reforming sentencing laws so that they're not so harsh and discriminatory. You know, he's talking up charter schools. He has a lot of issues that cut across a lot of lines. So I'm not sure whether it's entirely libertarian. You know, the other trend that he's kind of riding is reluctance to intervene overseas. He's, he's in sync with the public on a lot of this.
Now, here's a race that I would not have paid attention to until you told me to pay attention to it, and now I look at it, and it's very interesting. For those who want perhaps an indication of where midterms are going, what issues are going to be dealt with by the Republicans and the Democrats, you say pay attention to Florida's 13th District special election tomorrow. Why is it worth looking at?
Well, you know, we have to have the caveat that none of these elections are determinative in an overall midterm, but this one is kind of interesting. You've got two candidates, neither of whom is charismatic. Alex Sink is a woman who used to be the CFO, the Chief Financial Officer of Florida, And you have David Jolly, a former aide to the man who used to hold the seat, the late Bill Young, who's also a lobbyist. And so they're kind of evenly matched with low points on the magnetic scale, if you want to put it that way. And really, you've got a very evenly matched race for candidates, and it's translated into a very even match in polls. It's a dead heat. And one of the issues that is kind of looked at, you know, as this may be a test of Obamacare. So David Jolly is talking about repealing it, and Alex Sink is talking about fixing it. And so, you know, it's one of the truest tests of the law that we're going to see. But, of course, you know, there's always other issues, and there are other factors that intervene. There's also a Libertarian candidate on the ballot, so that could skew things a little bit. But it is a real interesting test.
Mm-hmm. Don't you need, though, somebody who's semi-magnetic to get people to the polls? Really?
Well, I don't know if you need semi-magnetic, but there's a lot of money being spent in this race, nearly $9 million so far from outside groups, and that doesn't even count the $3.5 million that the candidates are spending. So, I mean, it is huge. People are just investing huge amounts in this race because they see it as a referendum on some important issues. And, you know, there's already, I saw a 26% turnout, and Election Day isn't even till tomorrow. So early voting and absentee voting are going pretty well. The one other thing I ought to say, this outfit, Smart Politics at the University of Minnesota, does some calculations and finds that when there's a woman on a major party ticket in a special election, the woman wins more than 58% of the time.
Really? Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that. All right. Well, we'll watch this tomorrow. And you talk about Obamacare. The Gallup poll is out with a poll that's interesting, and I wonder if it will play into this election and into the debate, if the Republicans will pull back at all from a discussion of Obamacare. 15.9% of adults now uninsured. It's down from 17.1%. The iffy news, though, is that even though 18 to 34-year-olds are signing up, they're not signing up in the kinds of numbers that they need to make this plan really fly.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I'd also point out that there's three more weeks left in this sign-up, so they tend to do things at the last minute, and I say this from personal experience, having two sons that age.
I understand completely. I have one, too. Right.
So it's a little bit too soon to say, but, you know, this law is a phase-in, and I think it's going to take a while for people for the final statistics to be in. I don't think anyone expected it to be terrific right at the start, and, of course, right at the start it was anything but terrific. So, you know, it may be a disappointment. There are some studies, and there are some insurance company statements that this is not going to be make or break, you know, if they don't get to 40% this year.
So does it behoove the Republicans to stay on the issue of we need to repeal the Affordable Care Act? Is that a winning strategy for them, Jill, or not?
Well, I think it's a winning strategy in terms of fundraising and turnout. It's a very motivating strategy. And so, I mean, you know, I just don't think you're going to be able to get, I've thought about this a lot, people who get insurance through this and it's the first time and they're very grateful, they're not going to go out and organize, you know?
Right.
They're just happy to have insurance. And it's a different type of enthusiasm and motivation on the Republican side. You know, they see the Senate within reach, and this could tip any number of close races. So, you know, there's a lot of Democratic seats up that they have to defend. And so, you know, it's a very key aspect of the Republican strategy, and they're probably very smart to use it.
Mm-hmm. What do you make of Paul Ryan's comments on the war on poverty, the reasons how we can lower the poverty rate? And the first question is, why has he made this something that is sort of a centerpiece of what he's talking about these days?
I think the Republican Party understands that it comes off as uncompassionate these days, and they have an empathy gap, and they need to find policies that address problems that most Americans see. inequality, low income, you know, low wages, kind of falling behind in the economy. And some of the people at CPAC did address this, and Paul Ryan was one of them. Unfortunately, he addressed it with a story that was inaccurate and also, you know, I think made the opposite point that he wanted. He seemed to be implying that people who didn't have enough money to make brown bag lunches for their children didn't care about them. He mangled an anecdote about brown bag lunches versus school lunches, mm-hmm. Got taken to task for Pinocchio's from the Washington Post fact checker. So I guess, you know, the first lesson in talking about this is to get your anecdotes straight. That being said, I think one of the most key things that Paul Ryan said was in an appearance at, I think it was Brookings Institution a few weeks ago, where he was asked point blank whether the things he was proposing on poverty, which included trying to make sure people didn't have a big fall off in income as they, you know, made money and lost benefits, that went hand in hand with reducing the size of government, just cutting spending very sharply, and the justification for this being that that would improve the economy for everyone. So it's, you know, it always starts out with we have to cut spending.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure that that's going to fly as plausible anti-poverty policy.
You wrote an interesting piece a little while ago about the president being kind of stymied by some of the issues that were really near and dear to him. And one of them would have been a way to take on poverty, and that's to create jobs for people. I never fully understood, Jill, knowing that jobs are so important to the economy and to people's well-being, why there hasn't been any kind of bipartisan effort to stimulate this economy, to create jobs, because obviously they are needed and it would behoove all politicians to take this issue on, wouldn't it?
Well, I think that before the 2012 election, it was less puzzling because the objective was to make Obama a one-term president. And for that to happen, you know, he couldn't get credit for a roaring economy. I think maybe now we've moved on with Republicans to let's take over the Senate and prove that our way of doing things is the only way, is the right way to do things, the best way to improve the economy. The most puzzling part of it is that some of the things that aren't getting done are things that have been done in the past, for instance, infrastructure spending, even routine infrastructure spending, you know, for the transportation bill they're having trouble with. So, you know, even things with bipartisan support in the past and some with bipartisan support now are being blocked, and it's extremely dysfunctional, and we all know that. I just don't understand why Americans haven't kind of risen up and gone nuts over this. I think Democrats, you know, their corresponding strategy to the Obamacare strategy is minimum wage, and they've been absolutely talking about that every day. And I'm not sure it has any chance of getting through Congress. Even some of its most enthusiastic proponents don't think it's going to get through this Congress. So, but it is a mobilizing issue because it gets to these problems that people feel so acutely in their lives.
And what is the figure? Did you write this? There are three people looking for every one job?
That's right. That's right. So, yeah, we could use some stimulation, could use some ramping up.
But not likely to happen.
Not likely to happen. Yeah. I mean, possibly after the 2014 election, possibly a Republican Senate would be the best thing that could happen. Although then, you know, of course, their eyes are going to be on the 2016 White House race. So, you know, how much credit do you want to let Obama have or Democrats have for spurring the economy? I don't know.
Yeah. Jill Lawrence is our guest for All Things Political, and we're welcoming phone calls for her. Here is how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You can send an email as well. That's talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We have talked briefly about the CPAC conference. Who do you think were the stars there? What is the draw of Rand Paul? Would you agree that the Republicans have a problem here, or is it not an issue that it would affect them one way or another, of which party showing compassion and concern for people. The president's approval ratings, we haven't talked to Jill about this yet, have dropped. They're only at 41%. And she mentioned perhaps Republicans winning the Senate. How likely is that to happen? And why are the president's numbers so low? We'll move into international territory a little bit later on, an emergency aid package. And there's some disagreement in Washington about how much it should be for the Ukraine from the United States, Russian troops in Ukraine. Where is all of this going? We will talk about that. And this story that I don't know if you read this and were concerned about this as well, but this story about GM vehicles that suddenly turn off while you're driving and have evidently contributed to a number of deaths in this country. Consumers complaining for 11 years about this and nothing was done? How could this happen? We'll talk about that and other issues as well. To you in a moment, Jill Lawrence is our guest. She is a very respected national veteran journalist, has covered politics for a number of years, is a contributor to The Daily Beast and Al Jazeera America. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. To your phone calls now, all things political. A question for you, our audience, I'd like to hear your response. If you were fashioning what the talking points, the issues should be for the Republicans in midterm elections, what do you think is most effective for campaign purposes? And simultaneously, what do you think is most effective for Democrats? Our phone number, lines are open for you right now, 800-486-8655. Tim in Rice Lake is our first caller. Hi, Tim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It's an interesting program. I guess one of the things I would put this, your guest was talking about gridlock in Congress and not able to get anything done. A couple of things I think I would put the blame squarely on. Number one is Harry Reid. Before the government was shut down, the Republicans and Democrats in the House passed numerous appropriations bills that they sent to the Senate, and Harry Reid refused to even act on them because he wanted to shut the government down to make conservatives look bad. The second thing is I think this president, frankly, is very divisive. I mean, when he took office, he had a supermajority and could have done all the tax cuts and stuff that he constantly harps about. No one was going to stop him, but he didn't do it. Instead, he puts forth a piece of very, very controversial legislation with the health bill and then shuts all of the Republicans out. And then people are wondering, why don't Republicans want to work with this guy? He is not a uniter. He's been a divider. And anyhow, that's my comment.
All right. Thanks for your comment, Tim. Jill.
Well, I guess, you know, it kind of looks a little bit different from my perspective inside the Beltway here, because the stimulus package that the president put out had a lot of tax cuts in it, more than most Democrats wanted, because they were trying so hard to get Republican votes for it. And in terms of the health law, I mean, one of the reasons that Democrats were caught short when Scott Brown won the special election in Massachusetts was the length of time it took. And one of the reasons, I mean, the main reason that it took so long to do was that most of 2009 was spent with Senate Democrats and Republicans on the Finance Committee trying to negotiate. I personally sat through a markup in the House where a number of Republican ideas were considered and accepted to put into the bill. So, you know, there were all kinds of things going on, and it would have been unusual for a party to elect a president and have a supermajority in the Senate and a majority in the House and not try to get its work done. I mean, George Bush actually went for it and got quite a bit done, some with Democratic help. So, you know, this is what a president does. You know, he runs on something and then tries to get his agenda enacted. And so I don't think, you know, it was a surprise. Now, I'm not clear on why there was so much opposition to stimulus in particular, because that's kind of a traditional thing that you do during a recession. But, you know, for whatever reason, there's been a lot of animus towards the president, a lot of opposition, and, you know, that's hardened. I think that he had some optimism that if he were reelected, that there would be some room for compromise on issues like immigration, where there are Republican supporters in Congress. But that hasn't happened yet, and it's unclear that it ever will.
Why do you think his approval rating is only at 41%, Jill?
Well, I think that the paralysis in Washington reflects on him, and also, I mean, there's so many really unhappy things happening around the world, tragic things that he you know, he really can't do anything about, and no president could do anything about. We cannot really, you know, dictate the course of the Middle East or what's happening in Ukraine. And, you know, there's just all kinds of things that point up the fact that the United States is not in a position that it may have thought it was in years ago. It doesn't dominate the world. It can't at this point. And so, you know, there is that he's doing diplomacy, and this is an interesting aspect of CPAC and what's going on in the Republican Party now, this big split in whether there should be an emphasis on diplomacy or whether the United States should be more forceful, you know, whether the United States should lead efforts or whether should support, say, the European Union in dealing with the Ukraine drama. So, you know, these are all things that the president, and the president just seems impotent. He can't control the world, and he can't control Capitol Hill.
Let's go to Carolyn in Green Bay next. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, this is Carol from Green Bay.
Hi.
Hi. It just seems to me that voters, and maybe I've heard some polling numbers, but it seems that voters are able to separate right now what's going on with the president and what's going on with Congress, that more people are actually blaming the GOP members in Congress. And so I just wonder if that might, you know, be a different outcome for the midterms. I'd like to hear what you think.
Well, the polling is really interesting and kind of puzzling. I mean, it does show the president in the low 40s, but it shows Congress much lower than that, and Republicans in Congress are the lowest of all, I think in the 20s or maybe even lower. There have been polls that also show that majorities of the public agree with Democrats on most issues. But in the same poll, you'll see that most of them plan on voting for a Republican in the next election. So, you know, it's hard to know what you do in a case like that. Maybe people are thinking that Democrats are inept, you know, or that they're just sick of the way things are going. They want to try something new, no matter who it is. But purely on policy issues, and the president is compared to Republicans in Congress, the Democrats should have the advantage, and yet they don't.
Thanks very much, Carol, for your call. And by the way, I want to invite you to join the conversation. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Mondays at 1 o'clock here on the Ideas Network. We always do an All Things Political show. So as you can tell, we're talking about a lot of political topics and wondering what your thoughts are on a variety of issues. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. I want to ask you about the president's use of executive order, which I know that you have written about. How does he plan to use that in the years ahead, and how has he used it, to your mind, effectively recently?
Well, I think that the main way he can use it is to spotlight issues, and he did that with the minimum wage recently when he signed a minimum wage he raised the minimum wage for federal contract workers. And this is going to take a long time to take effect, and it's not going to really affect that many people. I've seen maybe up to 200,000 people. It's certainly not a substitute for what Congress could do if it raised the minimum wage just across the country. But it does spotlight what he thinks is important, and it also gives signals to states and localities that may be thinking of raising the minimum wage. It kind of adds some energy mm-hmm. to the rhetoric that Democrats are using on this. And so, you know, it's worthwhile. It's just very small scale. I think the main effect that he's going to have in the next couple of years with executive orders is on the environment, regulations on the environment and regulations on, you know, more efficient fuel standards and pollution regulation. So it's, you know, that could be where he makes the mark, and that is apparently what what he's hired some aides to do. So I would look in that area.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's done the same. He's done a small scale on immigration when he's letting the children without documentation stay and not be deported. People who are brought in as kids and now are trying to get jobs or go to college, that sort of thing. So he's not deporting those people. And again, that's a drop in the bucket, but it's something, and it focuses attention on all that needs to be done beyond that.
And our next caller wants to talk about energy. John in Rhinelander. Hi.
Hi. My question, your guest was talking earlier about maybe stimulating the economy by, you know, providing more funding towards transportation. My question is, it's kind of the 800-pound gorilla in the room that nobody sees when it comes to renewable energy. It could solve, you know, the job problems, the environment problems, and to my notion, it seems that nobody's talking about it. And from my perspective, the person that mentions that we're going to shift away from fossil fuels and away from subsidizing those, you know, harmful types of industries is going to get my vote.
You're very enlightened on that. I think what's happening here is that there was an enormous amount of money in the stimulus bill that went into renewable energy. It was like the largest program that we've ever had. And so to some extent, those industries are off and running, and you can see it in the Tesla turnaround. That was one of the car, you know, experimental car companies that that got a lot of help and is now doing extremely well. I think, you know, at this kind of geopolitical moment, people are focusing on the export of gas so that that the European Union and Ukraine are not so dependent on Russia. So in a way, it's not the right moment for that, but I don't think that those industries are dying by any means.
I want to talk just a little bit about Keystone, because you've written something that I'm sure some people in our audience will find controversial. Both the president and the secretary of state are champions of the environment. You've written with longstanding concerns about climate change. But you have written that stopping Keystone will not stop climate change. It's not in the best interest for the president to stop this project.
Well, if you read the State Department environmental impact report, it's hard to come away with the idea that this is the best fight to stand, you know, this is the best ground to make your fight on, because what they found is that this tar sands oil is going to be drilled anyway. It's going to be extracted anyway. It's going to be transported anyway, whether Keystone is built or not. And some of the alternatives for transport are incredibly dangerous. I mean, there's trains that have derailed, and there's one that wiped out a whole town in Canada. So the consequences are, you know, potentially more devastating than a pipeline leak, believe it or not. I read the report and I was pretty convinced. And the other thing is that it would enable us to export more gas, which is important at this point from a strategic standpoint. So, you know, once you see all the pros and cons and you just kind of look at it from the standpoint of, okay, where do you want to make your stand? Do you want to, if you're a Democrat, do you want to give this strategic tool to Republicans? It just doesn't seem worth it if it's going to be a wash from the standpoint of climate change. Now, I know there are environmentalists who say that we'll set a terrible example. It'll unleash a lot of, you know, pollution in other places from people who see what we're doing, but you know, just looking at it on the merits, it does not seem worth the fight.
Mm-hmm. And yet you can imagine, Jill, that there will be, because you know how vehemently those who are opposed to this feel about this issue, there will be a lot of demonstrations in this country should it go through.
Well, that may be true, but, you know, there's a lot of things that the president has done in the opposite direction to really, I mean, considering how he's crippled in Congress, he has really done a lot through executive orders and other kinds of policies to ease global warming. And I think, you know, that the people who are very upset about Keystone understand that. So, you know, it's just, there's no good decision for the president on this, but I think the way it's been going on and on and on is not to the advantage of anybody.
Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Jill Lawrence is our guest for All Things Political this hour, and she is a contributor to The Daily Beast and Al Jazeera America and is doing a research project on political primaries for the Brookings Institution. Phone calls are coming in. Before we go to our next one, I do want to spend a few moments on Ukraine and Russia and Crimea, which is up for grabs, it would appear. What's the latest here? Are those Russian troops just sitting there waiting for the referendum next Sunday, right? It's Sunday.
It's Sunday, and apparently there's no vote on it.
There's no no vote? Seriously?
Seriously, I think the choices are rejoin Russia or stay part of Ukraine under Russian control. Something like that. I mean, it's like the status quo is not an option.
So we're waiting for that to happen. Are we going to see Russian troops? We hear there are lots of them now. Are they just sitting there, or is there something?
Preparing, yeah, they're preparing to control the country, even though, you know, our president and other people around the world have said it's not a legal referendum. So the question is, what do we do once this happens? And if you look, there's a CNN poll out today that is very interesting. People approve of the way Obama is handling Ukraine, 48% to 43%. And the only thing that they would support in terms of a step to, you know, any kind of action on this is imposing economic sanctions on Russia. 59% favor that. There's no majority for anything else.
Really?
Giving economic assistance to the government there, 52% oppose. Canceling the G8 summit, 58% oppose. You know, sending weapons and other military supplies to the Ukrainian government, 76% oppose. I mean, it just, you know, airstrikes, 82%
goodness
oppose.
Yeah. That's amazing. Is that because of what's happened with us most recently in Afghanistan and Iraq? Or, I mean, does it signal
up? Well, Libya and, right. You know, I mean, the one time that Obama thought it'd be worth our while to intervene really backfired with a terrible tragedy. So,
yes.
You know, it just kind of underscored how dangerous it is to start intervening and giving weapons to people and waging airstrikes. I think people are just completely exhausted by all of this.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right. John, thank you very much for your call. We go to Carl in San Miguel, Mexico. Hi, Carl.
Hi there. I got a clarification. Those in the news know it, but it has never been mentioned on the air in any network, and it should be. The national minimum wage by law only affects the people doing interstate commerce. Okay, if you are a business that just works within one state, you're not affected by the federal. You're affected by the state.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. What do you think about the minimum wage, Carl? What do you think it should be?
Well, I know before I left Minnesota. Just figuring up my basic expenses to do nothing more than survive in Rochester, Minnesota, before I left, I needed $8 an hour, no taxes, no nothing. I needed that just to survive.
Mm-hmm.
forget going out anywhere, a restaurant or anything at all. Mm-hmm. Culturally. Just surviving. It was $8 an hour, so, and that was 18 years ago.
Hmm. Yeah, it's quite different now.
So
yeah.
take that on a note.
Right. Jill, you want to respond?
Well, even if a minimum wage only covers interstate commerce, that covers all the fast food places. It covers places like Walmart and Target, and, you know, just there's a lot of interstate commerce in our country, and that puts the pressure on more local businesses to up their wages. So, you know, I think the way we're headed, it's going to be states and localities that are taking the lead on this. And there's been some interesting research about, for instance, Washington State, which has had for about 15 years, they raised their minimum wage, and then they pegged it to inflation. They had it rising with inflation after that. And their economy has not suffered. They've done better than the country as a whole, in fact.
Thank you, Carl, very much for your call. We'll pause for a moment and return. All Things Political is what you're listening to this hour, March 10, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio with Jill Lawrence. Jill is contributor to The Daily Beast and Al Jazeera America. Our phone number, lines are crowded, but keep the number in mind, 800-486-8655. And remember, you can always send an email. That's talk@wpr.org. And we'll be back with you in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to more phone calls. Phil in McHenry, Illinois. Hi, Phil.
Hi. I'm just going to probably reinforce something your guest said. This winter, when I was standing in the steep snow with nothing to do, I went to the public library, and I happened on an issue of Trains Magazine, which is their kind of inside trade talk of the railroad industry. And the fellow was talking about the tar sands oil and the oil out of North Dakota, and he made the comment, I don't know who would build a tank car for you in the next 2 years in North America. The cars are being built. These fellows could care less about the Keystone Pipeline. And he said, the oil's going to move. It's economics. He said, The president can do whatever he wants to do. There's money that's going to be made here. And he said, they're moving the oil. He said, stand by a railroad track and watch those brand new tank cars go by. He said, that's the pipeline that's not being built. And he said, I think the railroad industry is happy with what's going on because he said they're going to make money doing it.
Interesting. Jill?
Well, that's, you know, certainly the best face on it. You know, the other side of it is the danger of rail travel for this sort of transport, for this sort of thing. So, I mean, you could make the argument that we're missing out on economic opportunity. It's not that there's going to be a huge number of permanent jobs from this, but there certainly would be a short-term surge of a couple thousand, 2,000 to 3,000, I believe it was. And that, you know, that's what we're looking for right now, is some short-term surge to kind of get things back on track.
Let's move from railroads to highways for a moment and cars on highways. I'm sure that you're familiar with this story, which I found incredible, the recall of GM cars with consumer complaints over 11-year period of time. People died because they were driving along in their GM car, and all of a sudden it would just stop working. You know, the acceleration, just the car turned off, essentially. Why was there not more of a response from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration or from GM? This is an amazing story to me.
Well, it really is. And I mean, it sounds like everybody fell down on the job across the board.
Yes.
And now, of course, there's a new, new CEO at GM, and she's resolving to get to the bottom of it. But what's interesting is that for the first time, everybody wants names. You know, who was at this meeting? Who signed off on this? And it's all been very vague in the past. But now it sounds like very belatedly they're trying to get the details.
It just, for so many years, for this to be a problem is just incomprehensible. Somebody's really falling down on the job. And we gave them a lot of money to keep them going, right?
Well, I was
right?
just going to say,
right.
This is all happening at the time when they've been bailed out by the government. So maybe they were preoccupied. I don't know.
Let's go.
I mean, it'd be interesting to get the union take on it, too.
Our guest is Jill Lawrence, and our phone number is 800-486-8655. You're listening to All Things Political, and we go to John in Fond du Lac next. Hi, John.
Yes, good afternoon. I just wondered if your guest could comment on a recent thing that I read, that part of our problem with gridlock in Washington is due to the election process, specifically the primary election process, in which the real contest for seats in the House or the Senate really occurs at the primary level, and that we have so many districts now that are not competitive due to redistricting, and that's kind of where our problem comes from, because we tend to produce candidates for either party who appeal to the extreme and who have no interest then in compromising because they want to retain their seat, and they're not, what they really have to worry about is appealing to the base to win the primary election, which then guarantees them pretty much an election to either the Senate or the House because of the redistricting.
Well, I do think that the district, the makeup of the district is a big part of the problem. But there's another part of the problem, which is turnout. And, you know, you have very, very small turnouts in primaries, and it's usually the most hardcore in both parties. And so,
right.
You know, for the on the Republican side, then that means that a Tea Party candidate would win a primary, for instance, the way a lot of them did in 2010, maybe not perhaps the strongest candidate and not the one that could attract the broadest support. And on the Democratic side, you'll have the same sort of thing. You know, you'll only have your loyalists showing up. So part of the problem is the way the districts are drawn, and that they're not going to be redrawn again until 2020. So we still have a few years of these districts. I think by making voting in primaries easier more public, giving them more publicity, there may be a way to change the makeup of the candidates. But, you know, part of it also just has to do with the way the Senate works and the way the House works, the way the Founding Fathers organized our country. It wasn't supposed to be very you know, action was kind of the last resort. It wasn't supposed to be easy to do things. And you can see that for sure in the Senate, where either 40 people or even just one person can gum things up. So, you know, there's a lot of reasons for the gridlock, I guess is what I'm saying.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Joan. How many, I wonder if we have a good sense, Jill, about restrictions on early voting, voter ID, et cetera. How many of those will be in place to make an impact on the midterms?
You know, I think that's still in flux.
Is it?
And some, you know, some of the regulations are more, have the potential to restrict voting more than others. You know, in some cases, there's been shortening of early voting periods, but there's still plenty of time to early vote, that sort of thing. Some of the ID laws are egregious, and it's not at all clear to me that they're going to be allowed to actually apply to the election. I mean, in Texas, there was a situation where your hunting license was a sufficient ID, but your student ID was not. So, you know, there are some that seem fairly arbitrary, and it's Eric Holder, the Attorney General, is being really aggressive on this. So we'll see. You know, once again, there are some people in Congress who have a bipartisan fix on the Voting Rights Act, and there are standards that could be put into effect, but I doubt it's going to go anywhere this year.
Alan, our next caller. Hi, Alan.
Hi. I was just wondering how the American people are going to survive after all the major corporations have moved to Mexico and China and Korea and all the others. And they can't afford health benefits. They can't afford to feed their families. How can they compete with $2 an hour in Mexico and then have the Mexican people come up here and we fund them with schooling and all these other things? And another question is why did Bill Clinton give the Panama Canal to China when we could have re-signed the lease? And China's a major, we import from them a lot.
I bet you never thought that would come up today, Jill.
Well, I was just going to say, I really have to take a pass. I recuse myself from that question.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay, it's
in
fine.
Terms of manufacturing, my understanding is that wages are going up in China. And so, you know, that, and of course at home we see that unions are making a lot of compromises and they're also, you know, under siege in a lot of places, and which may be the reason for the compromises. But, you know, their wages are not as high as they used to be. The ultimate goal of the Affordable Care Act is to lower the price of health care, and it's unclear whether it will be successful, but it is very much the infancy of this law. There are parts of it that are meant to get a grip on health costs, and they haven't really taken effect yet. So, you know, we're going to have to see how this plays out, and also whether Congress gets its act together to do entitlement reform on Medicare, which, you know, if they can enact some savings in various ways, that may have an impact on the entire healthcare market. So there are ways that we may get these costs under control, and I really don't see all corporations leaving the country. There may even be corporate tax reform at some point. There's a lot of people talking about it.
How long do you think I don't know if there's a way of knowing this, we have to give the Affordable Care Act before we know, Jill, if it's been a success?
Well, I guess I'd say there are a lot of ways to judge it. You know, if you talk to the parent of someone under 26 who stayed on a family plan, it's already been a success. For people with pre-existing conditions who were frozen out of the market, it's been a success. For people who are, you know, getting the Medicaid extension, you know, there have been a lot of people who've benefited from it already, including anyone who's ever had a preventive care exam that they didn't have to pay for, which is probably almost all of us. So, and it's the kind of macro situation on the insurance market and, you know, whether there's standards of care and how the medical providers industries reorganize themselves to become more efficient and, you know, stop things like having people have to be readmitted because they got an infection in the hospital, that sort of thing. There's ways to make care better that are also cheaper. So, you know, that's the hope. I think it'll be another 10 years before we see what's happening, and I'm sure there's going to be a lot of tweaking along the way.
Thanks so much, Ellen, for your call. Sarah in Zion, Illinois. Hi.
Hi. Well, thank you, Kathleen. Joe, I know there's not time for me to say what I want to say, but if there were time, I would rebut every single thing you said about the Keystone Pipeline, because I don't think it's the most logical conclusion. But the one thing that I will say is that the report, the so-called State Department report, was done by a consulting firm whose board of directors is made up of the same names that are board of directors of oil companies. So this is not an independent consulting firm. And its conclusions, I think, are really suspect, especially the one about that the oil will be shipped anyway. I think that is a strategy that the oil companies and the Harper Canadian government came up with because they know that's the argument that's going to win over the U.S.
And just for your note and future reference, we are going to be talking about the Keystone for a full hour next week. But, Jill, would you like to respond?
Well, I know that there have been some objections to the authors of that report, the people who did the study, and there's been a lot of examination into them. And, you know, there have been findings that it's that there have been no conflicts of interest. So, I mean, I'm sure people are going to disagree on that. In terms of whether the oil gets shipped anyway, you can see the trains. I mean, it's going to happen. So, you know, I think it'd be more of a symbolic move than anything else. And, you know, the question is, do we want to make a stand there? Do we want to sacrifice the short-term employment? You know, it's a risk, but so is the train. The trains are a risk, and they would be coming through the United States. They'd be coming through New England. So it's, you know, there's a lot of pros and cons, but I read the report, and that's where it came down, and I didn't expect to come down on that side.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Thanks, Sarah, and listen in next week. Alan in Madison, hi.
Hello.
Hi, Alan. Go ahead.
Yes, the pipeline that you were speaking of and the dangers of, you know, hauling the oil with train or trucks, and I agree with that, but has anybody thought about the security of those pipelines? I mean, you have miles and miles of pipelines, and with the world that we live in today, would they be safe?
Well, you know, I don't recall too much about that in the report that I read. I have to think that there have been that has been given some attention. But I'm not going to pretend to be an expert on that aspect of it.
Thanks for the call. What are you looking at this week, Jill? What do you expect to be covering?
Well, I'm writing about Rand Paul and cogitating on CPAC, which we haven't really talked all that much about, but it was pretty interesting. There's the whole Chris Christie saga that's unfolding, so we're all paying attention to that. And then there's kind of a little bit of a Marco Rubio comeback, and with him really taking on the president on foreign policy. So I'll be following that. And he's actually, even as we speak, delivering remarks on poverty and the economy. Yes, he's talking about how to revive the economy. He and Paul Ryan are kind of on parallel tracks this year. So that's another track to be following. The Republicans are really very fascinating these days, I think much more so than the Democrats.
And Chris Christie, what kind of response did he get from CPAC members? Is he still in the game?
It was civil. I mean, he talked a lot about his fellow governors, and he doesn't like the media, as we know, and he called the Democrats the party of intolerance. The problem, I think, is that, you know, what people liked about him was he was so in your face. You know, he was really in your face with reporters and union members and teachers, and he can't be like that anymore, and he wasn't like that at CPAC because it kind of makes you wonder whether maybe he really did close that bridge. You know, this is you know, he has to really downplay the aspect, the kind of bulldog aspect, the pit bull aspect that people really liked about him. So we'll have to see how that develops.
And do you have any inside information of why our governor, Scott Walker, did not go to CPAC?
You know, I'm not sure, but I think he was probably smart not to go.
Really?
It's interesting in that you do get some credible potential candidates and you hear what they have to say. On the other hand, you know, Scott Walker was not going to win the straw poll. And you're up there and you've got Donald Trump and you've got Sarah Palin. You've got people who are not really, you know, serious candidates.
Mm-hmm.
So it's you know, you have Ann Coulter. There, it's just kind of a little bit superfluous, I guess, if you're a state executive.
Mm-hmm.
Especially Jill, him, you know.
Yeah, thank
He's got to win an election.
That's true. There's one coming up. Thank you so much. Yeah. It's always a great pleasure to have you on. Your wealth of information. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Kathleen.
Jill Lawrence, our guest for All Things Political this hour of the program. She is now a contributor to The Daily Beast, and Al Jazeera America has been covering politics for a long time. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing the show, and to Cynthia Schuster for on-air production in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. And thanks for listening.